today at Reader's Corner, we talked to best-selling author and journalist Mark Omasek about his new book, The Storm on Our Shores, One Island, Two Soldiers, and the Forgotten Battle of World War II. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. It's May 1943. The Battle of Attu between American and Japanese forces is raging on the Aleutian Island. With an Arctic cold, impenetrable fog, and rocketing winds that combine to create some of the worst weather on Earth, in this unlikely place, a highly decorated American sergeant discovers a Japanese surgeon's war diary and finds solace for his own tortured soul. In his latest book, The Storm on Our Shores, best-selling author Mark Omasek tells a heart-wrenching but ultimately redemptive story of two World War II soldiers on opposite sides of the field of battle and a diary that changed our war-torn society's perceptions of Japan. Mark Omasek is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, best-selling author of The Big Year and Halfway to Heaven. He won the 2009 National Outdoor Book Award for Outdoor Literature, the 2003 National Press Club Award for Environmental Journalism, and was the lead writer for the Denver Post team that won the Pulitzer Prize in 2000 for its coverage of the Columbine shootings. Mark Omasek, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thanks for having me.
Mark, I'm often asked, after doing about 550 of these author interviews on books like yours and books not so much like yours, what's your favorite? What's the ones that stick out? And the number one answer I give is a book by Samuel Pisar called Of Blood and Hope. Pisar was a young man who survived the Nazi death camps and went on to become an international lawyer and worked with the International Olympic Committee. And then I give them A Higher Call by Adam Makos, which is the story that comes closer to your story because it's the story of a German and an American flyer who meet up over the skies of Europe and later are reunited after the war. From this moment on, when people ask me what are my greatest memories about a book and about a situation and whatever, I have to add The Storm on Our Shores. I just think it's one of the most interesting, touching reads. I don't know how anybody reads this without shedding a few tears. I certainly did. You've done a magnificent job here. It's my understanding that you stumbled across Attu somewhat accidentally when you got into the bird business. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, I'm really honored and flattered by what you said before. I'm really grateful. You're right. This isn't my natural field of reporting. I actually found out about the story when I had been researching a story on competitive bird watching, of all things. I did a book called The Big Year, and it was a true story about three men in a contest to see how many different species of birds they could spot in 1 year in North America. And really important parts of that book, turns out, happened on this place called Attu Island, a place I'd never heard of. The westernmost point of the Aleutian chain is so far out there that they actually curved the international dateline around it to keep North America on the same calendar page. It's as far west as New Zealand. And it turns out it was a fantastic place for birders to go and find weird, rare species during migration. It's got some of the worst weather on Earth, Attu Island does, and they get blown off course. Asiatic species would get blown off course, and North American birders would come and try to see these Asian birds. Well, when I was researching the history of this island, I saw that Japan had actually invaded and conquered it 6 months after Pearl Harbor. I mean, Japan had taken part of Alaska during World War II. I didn't know that. That it was the first U.S. soil lost since the War of 1812. Didn't know that either. Also didn't know that it was a really brutal battle. The casualty rate there was exceeded in the Pacific War only at Iwo Jima. And so the elements there were interesting. But, you know, frankly, I'm not a historian. I'm a journalist. And I am more interested in the stories of people. But when I learned that there was an American war hero who had found the diary of an American-trained Japanese soldier whom he had killed on the island, and then had spent 40 years trying to find and reconcile with that Japanese soldier's family. I mean, I was just hooked. I'd never heard of such a story. It was so powerful and moving to me about the power of peace and atonement and forgiveness. And I was hooked.
Well, let's unpack this by starting with Paul Nobuo Tatsuguchi. Is that how you pronounce his name? Or am I close?
Yes.
Yeah. So tell us about him and how he gets to America and what he does in America and his religion and the role that plays.
Sure. Paul Tatsuguchi is a Hiroshima native who his family was Christian, really a minority in Japan. He was Seventh-day Adventist. And so he came over and went to college at Pacific Union College in the Napa Valley of Northern California, and then went to med school at Loma Linda University in Southern California, and actually did a medical residency at White Memorial Hospital in Los Angeles as a surgeon. And he really fell in love with America, Paul Tatsuguchi did. He was thrilled by the big buildings and the sense of freedom and the sense that you could kind of make, in some ways, you could make your own future. So much of Japan, your destiny was set by who your parents, your grandparents, and your great-grandparents were. But America was more wide open. And so he fell in love with America so much, actually, that he brought his girlfriend over from Japan and proposed to her at Yosemite National Park. They married in Los Angeles. And for their honeymoon, they actually took off on one of the first Greyhound bus tours of the United States. They went from L.A. all the way to Niagara Falls in New York. And what more American thing can you do during that era but honeymoon at Niagara Falls? When they returned, there was a telegram waiting for him saying that there had been a tragedy while they were away. Both of Paul's parents had died while Paul was off and his new wife were off on their honeymoon. And Paul's brother somehow, nobody can really explain it, but he panicked and sold his sister into prostitution, into a brothel in Manchuria. And so Paul and his wife pick up and leave California and return to Japan to buy his sister out of a brothel. And of course, Pearl Harbor happens and Paul Tatsuguchi is conscripted against his will to fight for Japan against the nation he loves, the United States.
Now, his winding up on the island of Attu has something to do with the fact that he came over from America to Japan. He wasn't exactly the most trusted member of the Japanese army, I gather. And that did that have something to do with why he'd wind up in this remote outpost?
Yeah, you're exactly right. His countrymen didn't trust him. They thought that he had become too Americanized. Many people suspected that he had become an American spy. He spoke fluent English. He adopted many of the Western mannerisms that we had here in the United States. His faith, it's a Shinto Buddhist country, and you know, he was a devout Christian, Seventh-day Adventist. And so they treated him with a lot of skepticism. And so what do you do with a guy that you're not quite sure about? I mean, Japan had been fighting a war in China well before what Americans tend to consider the launch of World War II. And so Japan was really hard up for men. They needed good fighting men, and especially they needed people who were terrific trained surgeons like Paul Tatsuguchi. And so they needed him, but they didn't really trust him. And so they sent him to this place that nobody had ever really heard of called Attu Island.
And meanwhile, I don't think his family knew where he was, did they?
No. It's war. It's top secret. He can write letters home to his wife. Actually, they have at this time, while Paul is shipped out, they have just a toddler daughter, 2 years old, and his wife is pregnant with another. And Paul can write some postcards home, but he can't say where he is or on what dates. And it's just a lot of uncertainty with his wife back home with one small daughter at home, another on the way. And sure enough, one day out of the blue, she gets a really ominous signal. She gets a lock of Paul Tatsuguchi's hair mailed to her. This is the tradition in the Imperial Army. If a man is going to be sent to fight in a battle where his odds are not good of surviving, men would send a lock of their hair back as kind of a final keepsake. And so that is exactly what happens to Paul. Tasuguchi cuts a lock of his hair, mails it to Aiko, and she just gets this keepsake from her husband. Doesn't know where he is or where he's going, but just a lot of uncertainty. Paul, of course, has ended up at this awful place, Attu Island, some of the worst weather on Earth. There's only 8 days a year that are free of either snow or rain or sleet or fog. It's at the confluence of the really cold Bering Sea currents and the warmer Pacific currents. And so this confluence of cold and hot makes for awful weather. Fog, you know, many soldiers described not being able to see the barrel of their gun. The fog was so dense. But especially because of the mix of warmer and cold, there's this bizarre weather phenomenon called Willawas, which are these spontaneous winds, hurricane force winds, you know, 60 to 120 miles an hour that come out of nowhere without warning. And they rocket down from the 3,000 foot mountains of Attu. Actually, it's a volcanic place. So the 3,000 foot volcanoes that are ice encrusted down to the shore. And these winds literally will knock you off your feet. They did that to me when I camped there in September.
I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Mark O'Masek, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author of The Storm on Our Shores. In the book, O'Masek tells a heart-wrenching but ultimately redemptive story of two World War II soldiers on opposite sides of the field of battle. You camped there to get a better feel for this book, or was that when you were doing the birding book?
I camped there for this book. Actually, I went out with a crew from 60 Minutes, the television news show, which did a story on this story. And it's a crazy thing. Attu Island is 1,500 miles from Anchorage, and it's uninhabited. Nobody lives there. And so, to my knowledge, nobody has lived there. Definitely nobody's lived there full time for at least 8 or 9 years. Nobody had landed a plane on the island for 2 years. And so we take off from the nearest civilian population, which is at another Aleutian island called Adak. It's about 500 miles away, and we don't know whether we're going to be able to land on the island or not. We don't know what kind of shape the runway is in. It's a really seismic area because it's on a volcano fault, and plus the fogs are so persistent and so brutal. We actually took off from Adak Island to fly 500 miles to Attu and never even knew if we'd be able to see the island because fog is so dense.
So it's 1943, and the American Army decides it's going to retake Attu, and so it heads for Attu with thousands of American soldiers, including a guy by the name of Dick Laird. Tell us about Dick Laird.
Well, Dick Laird grew up poor, really poor, in Appalachia, and by age 14 was forced to drop out of school and start work as a coal miner. By age 16, he was underground working as an explosives expert. Now, at this time in the 20s, the 30s in the U.S., coal mining is a really dangerous job. And Laird is in accidents himself. His friends are getting hurt, maimed, some killed. He sees accidents all over Appalachia where there are explosions, there are collapses, people are getting killed. And so Dick Laird ultimately decides that he's got to get out of Appalachia, and he decides that his safer course is going to be to join the U.S. Army. That's his ticket out. And so he does and ends up training with his fellow 10th Division troops in Southern California because they are preparing in the Mojave Desert to fight Rommel and the Nazis in the desert sands of North Africa. Well, sure enough, the Japanese had invaded and conquered this place called Attu in Alaska, and the United States would not let this stand. You know, it was the first U.S. territory lost since the War of 1812. If you're a general sitting in an office in Tokyo or Washington, you could look at a map of Attu and say, hey, this could be a pretty valuable military target. This might be a place for Japan to build an advanced base that would help launch attacks against the west coast of the United States. The only people who thought that Attu would have military value are people who have never been to Attu. The weather, as we talked about, is really awful. It is cold because of fog. You can't land planes there with any regularity. The shores are so rocky. 95% of the – it's actually – Attu's a pretty big island. It's 15 times bigger than Manhattan. but 95% of that island is set off by cliffs. So you can't really land landing craft there.
Yeah.
Of course, we know all this today. At the time, they didn't really. And so the Japanese had taken it. And 6 months after the initial Japanese invasion, it was time for Dick Laird and the Americans to take it back. And so the U.S. did send, the generals did send a bunch of men. Ultimately, almost 100,000 troops were assigned to the Aleutians. But these were men who were trained to fight in the desert. They had desert clothes, most importantly, desert boots, really thin. And they were getting sent to Alaska, and it was just kind of a recipe for disaster. The U.S. generals said that battle there would last no more than 3 days, and the Japanese turned out to be really shrewd, smart, strategic fighters, and the battle lasted nearly 3 weeks.
You know, what I found amazing about your story is when we read history and we read the history of one battle in a book that somebody has written like yours, we oftentimes get the impression that the soldiers that we're talking about that are in the book, they do this one thing and they go home or they go back to their base. I think you said that Dick Laird, by the time he was finally sent home, had been to 5 beachheads in the Pacific Theater. So this is a guy that would get out of one kettle of hot water and get thrown into another. You did a masterful job of helping us understand the Pacific Theater and the way these servicemen were just moved around from one dangerous ground to another.
Well, it was war. I mean, both the United States and Japan were in an existential conflict. And when you are fighting for the literal life of your country, there's no time off for good service.
Right.
They need all hands on deck. And so what happened was Paul Taseguchi had been assigned to Attu, and he's working as a surgeon there. And he starts to write a war diary. And it's kind of in the cold clinical style of a doctor. Not a lot of emotion, but still really chilling. He talks about performing amputations while he's being strafed by aircraft fire. He's ducking shrapnel while he's suturing patients in a cave. He is just under extraordinary, awful circumstances that he is writing. It's really what he's done is he has left the last account of what it's like to be on the wrong end of the most powerful military in the history of the earth. And finally, this Japanese force of 3,000 men, they'd been abandoned by their military. No hope was coming to get them. No help was coming to get them. And so they were, after 3 weeks of a U.S. air, ground, and naval assault, after 3 weeks, the Japanese garrison had been reduced from 3,000 men down to perhaps maybe just 500. And so the Japanese commander gathers his men together and says, this is it. We're going to mount a final desperate bonsai attack. They had run out of ammo. They had run out of food. They had run out of hope. And so they set off on this morning through the fog. And Dick Laird, the U.S. serviceman from Appalachia, hears something outside of his tent, looks up on a knoll above his tent and finds that the U.S. mortar has been captured by a squad of 8 Japanese soldiers. They are turning the mortar back so that it no longer points toward the Japanese, but they're turning it back on the American forces themselves. Laird knows that this could change the course of the battle. And so he sneaks up through the fog and pulls the pin on his grenade, waits, and then hurls it. And then he goes and does it again. And he goes up and finds that there are survivors, and he finishes them. He finishes them. There are no Japanese survivors, 8 men. Dick Laird wins the Silver Star, or is awarded the Silver Star for his bravery and courage in conduct. He's in some ways really held back the last desperate Japanese bonsai attack. It turns out to be one of the biggest bonsai attacks of the war. What he does, though, is he looks on the ground and tries to gather any intelligence that he can, as he's trained to do as a good soldier. And he finds an address book that is written in English and full of names from California. These are the medical school classmates of Paul Taseguchi. Laird also finds a handwritten document in Japanese. Of course, Laird can't read it, so he shoves that in his pocket and sends it to the back lines to be translated. He really hopes, that this document contains some sort of significant military intelligence that is going to help the U.S. finally beat back this Japanese counterattack. And when the translation comes back it turns out to be even more devastating, because what it shows is really no military intelligence, but it shows that Dick Laird has killed a man, not really in a lot of ways unlike himself, a man. He's killed Paul Tachiguchi, who didn't want to be in Alaska any more than Dick Laird wanted to be in Alaska. And he sees that Tachiguchi is married and he has a deep faith, deep Christian faith, and that he has daughters who he loves as well. Laird himself is a father. And this really disturbs Laird. Though he does win the Army's third highest military honor, the Silver Star, he still can't get over this feeling that maybe he's done something wrong. And so he can't sleep that night. He can't sleep that week for the rest of the war. And Laird, as you mentioned before, goes on to fight in some of the most brutal beachheads of the Pacific War, Kwajalein, Leyte in the Philippines, Okinawa. But he's just haunted by nightmares that he did what his country asked. He did the best that he could, and yet he just can't get over this feeling that he did something wrong, that he killed the wrong guy. And so finally, the war is over. Laird goes home as a war hero, makes a career as an asbestos guy in Arizona, but he is still traumatized by nightmares in so many ways. I mean, 40 years after the war, his life is defined by 3 weeks on this awful, cold, foggy island in Alaska.
You're listening to Reader's Corner. My guest today is Mark Omasek, author of The Storm on Our Shores. Isn't this today what we would call PTSD? And back in World War I and World War II, it was probably shell shock. I mean, the guy was living with this for most of his life before he finally decided, I need to do something about this. And I don't mean necessarily solve all of his PTSD issues, because those were for various reasons, but at least track down the family, right?
He does. He sets off to find the family of the man who wrote this diary that has haunted him for so many years. And so one day, totally out of the blue, he knocks on the door of a house in Sherman Oaks, California. And the door is opened by a middle-aged, or actually not middle-aged, but I guess in her 30s, woman. And Laird starts talking about how he just starts babbling. I don't think he really thought it through. And he starts talking about how he'd always dreamed of retiring to Arizona, and he loves to grow these orchids, and he loves photography, and he's got grandkids. And finally, the woman, who's got five-year-old twins, just cuts him off and says, "It's nice meeting you, but really, I don't have time for this. I got to go." And she walks him out to his car, and Laird opens his driver's door and kind of turns over his shoulder and says, "Oh, by the way, I'm the one who killed your father."
Wow.
This is his meeting with Laura Tachiguchi Davis. She is the girl who Paul Tachiguchi, the Japanese surgeon, had referred to in his diary, the daughter he had never met. He was shipped out. And so Laura, of course, had never met her father. She really only knew him as photographs on a wall. And so she'd always kind of known a little bit about how her father had died, but she never really knew how he lived. And so Laura sets off on her own personal quest and tries to determine what kind of man Paul Tachiguchi was. She contacts his former med school classmates, medical interns, and eventually Laura, just to settle her own head, calls up Dick Laird. And it's just the most remarkable thing, because here is the daughter of the man killed by a U.S. serviceman, and she goes out to lunch with him. And Laird, it's awkward to say the least, but they're polite. I mean, she's eating lunch with the man who killed her father. She can tell that something still troubles Laird. He won't say it. Maybe it's a generational thing, but so many servicemen of this generation just wouldn't talk about, you know, their feelings or PTSD or shell shock. They were just kind of stoic. It was just kind of expected. You're supposed to take it. And so Laura actually sits down that night and writes one of the most moving letters. She realizes that she's the one person who can give Laird something, and she does. She grants him peace and atonement. And she says that it was a kill or be killed situation. Both men were defending their countries. Nobody wanted to be there. They were following the orders of some higher-ups doing their duty. And yet it was up to them, the families, to figure it out. And it's just, it's so moving. And Laird's moved to tears. This hard war hero sergeant is moved to tears and says, for the first time in 40 years, he can sleep without nightmares. And it just, it was really something for me to move it in some ways along to the present day, because I just feel, you know, we're a divided country. We are a divided country right now. Mm-hmm. And here are two people, two families, one killed the other, and yet they could figure it out. They could find common ground. They could find peace. They could find atonement. They could do forgiveness. And you know what a country this is. That I just, in this book, I just kind of concluded that, you know, the politicians declare wars and the generals direct them, but ultimately it's people like Dick Laird and Paul Tatsuguchi and their families who fight them and who have to live with the consequences. And some are more able to live with consequences than others. But in this case, the Laird and the Tatsuguchi families, to me, served up such a really moving example of what we can be at our best.
Mm-hmm. Laura Tatsuguchi Davis had one more opportunity to try to bring old enemies together, I guess you could say. She returned to Attu for the 50th anniversary and gave a speech, an incredible speech. Could you tell us a little bit about how that went? Because that long ago, and how many years had passed, that was still tough for some folks.
Yes, it was very tough. The Japanese government had come, and with the permission of the U.S. government, built an 18-foot kind of a titanium star, like a big sculpture, and they called it a peace memorial. And some U.S. vets, when Laura went to speak on Attu, some U.S. vets were really upset that the Japanese government had been allowed to build a peace memorial on Attu, where there were, you know, 3,000 Japanese troops and I think only 28 survivors. And so many, you know, U.S. casualties, casualty rate exceeded only at Iwo Jima. And Laura ultimately, after talking with her mother, I mean, she talked with her mother, and her mother said, you know, you can go through life bitter. You can go through life with a heart full of hate. But if you become the vessel that holds hate, it will corrode you. And Laura kind of wished the vets well. She understood their point. It was a good one and a fair one. But to hold on to such bitterness, she thought was just destructive. And she chose peace and hope, and at least for me, provided a pretty moving example.
Well, this is an amazing, amazing story, and there's a lot we've left out. One of the things that I thought you did very well in the book was helping us remember, for those of us that knew that much about the Pacific Theater in World War II, you take us through it in a way that brings it back to life and death, unfortunately, even down to Truman's decision to drop the A-bomb. You managed to help us understand what was going on in the Pacific Theater and why Truman made that decision. I just think there's so many aspects to this that our listeners are going to love. So we're out of time, Mark, but I want to thank you so much for coming on to Reader's Corner, and most importantly for writing this book, which, as you say, is important in our times as well as in the times this all occurred. The name of the book, The Storm on Our Shores, One Island, Two Soldiers, and the Forgotten Battle of World War II by Mark Omasek. Mark, thanks so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Oh, thanks. That was really wonderful. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research and production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.